Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This last week of summer hasn't been a slow one in the news business. The debate over health care heats up, Afghanistan takes center stage, fires in Southern California and swine flu are top of mind. On Wednesday, White House senior advisor David Axelrod spoke about President Obama's much-anticipated primetime speech on health care next week.
We're just trying to get the job done here, trying to get something important done for the American people that Washington has punted on for years and decades. And we believe this is the best way to kick off the final discussions, the final debate.
And yesterday, at a press conference, Defense Secretary Robert Gates took reporters' questions about Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan will go on, he said, but he also acknowledged that Americans were growing weary of the fight.
The nation has been at war for 8 years. The fact that Americans would be tired of having their sons and daughters at risk and in battle is not surprising.
And wildfires in Southern California have wreaked havoc on foothill communities. One resident of Tujunga, California, describes what it was like.
It was a hellfire. It just came through here. It was unbelievable. And the ash and the heat, and it was just a roaring flame.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. And please join the conversation. What's your top story? Have you been following the healthcare debate? What should President Obama say next week in his primetime address? And what about the economy? Is it rebounding? How do you see it in your neck of the woods? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Janine Zakaria. She's diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. Janine, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jackie.
Hello there. And also from Washington, D.C., we're joined by Jonathan Weissman, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we decided to make it a Washington trifecta today because also with us from the same place is Newsweek contributing editor Eleanor Clift. And Eleanor, it's great to have you back.
Hi, Jackie.
And since you're all in the same studio, folks, you know, you can easily jump in on each other, right?
We could yell at each other.
You can. Well, obviously, healthcare is, I think, going to be the predominant issue next week because of President Obama's primetime address. They're playing defensive in the administration, or at least at the top. Let's just start by laying down this marker with what White House senior advisor David Axelrod told reporters this week, admitting in plain sight that the administration has suffered a few setbacks during the debate.
There's no doubt, you know, this has been a vituperative debate. Not everybody's dealt from the top of the deck on it, and that's the nature of these things. We've taken some dings along the way.
Jonathan, you've been covering this a lot for the Wall Street Journal. Do you want to take a crack at where the fault lines are?
Well, you know, we're going to start seeing those fault lines emerge, and we're going to start seeing how the president is going to address them. As early as Monday on Labor Day, when he goes to Cincinnati to this massive AFL-CIO picnic, he's going to be going with Richard Trumka, the Secretary General of Secretary Treasurer of AFL-CIO, who has said that any politician who does not embrace and stand by a so-called public option, a government-run insurance plan that would be that people could buy into. Anyone who does not stand by that cannot expect the unions to stand by them next year in what will be a very tough election. We'll see how he finesses that. He then has a meeting on Tuesday with the leadership of the House and the Senate, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi. And then on Wednesday, the big speech comes. And, you know, the biggest fault line is going to be on this public option. But remember, he also has to bring down the cost of this to woo some Republicans, specifically Susan Collins of Maine, who wants a less expensive plan. The only way to get a less expensive plan is to cut back on the subsidies that the plan has for the purchase of insurance by individuals who will be mandated to buy that insurance. And that's going to be very tough. This is really going to be a showdown between the president and his left flank.
And beyond that, this notion of wooing these Republican senators from Maine, Eleanor, is this because it is so important to this administration to have a bipartisan deal? Does one senator make it a bipartisan deal?
I don't think one senator makes it a bipartisan deal, but it makes it a little bit easier, I think, to argue to the country that he tried to get Republican support and that it's not his fault that he didn't get it. But the month of August, the debate was really stolen by a very angry minority of people showing up at the town meetings, and they really have colored the debate. And I think the president has like 6 days to find out if the bulk of the country is behind him and is behind a more aggressive approach to health care reform. And I think it's going to be a very hard sell to Democrats that they would lose really a key component of reform, and that is an opportunity for people to choose a publicly underwritten a plan that would be similar to what older people enjoy with Medicare as a way to put pressure on the insurance companies to be more competitive and to trade away the support on the left, and really not just the left, virtually the entire Democratic Party with the exception of the conservatives, self-named blue dogs, to trade that all away for one or two Republican votes seems like it's not really a good deal for the president. And if his supporters are so disheartened by his behavior, he could pay a price in next year's congressional elections. And I think everybody's mindful of what's at stake here in the control of the Congress when those elections happen just a little more than a year from now.
But, you know, this is more about vote counting than claims of bipartisanship. The fact is, with Senator Kennedy's seat now open, the Democrats have 59 seats in the Senate, 58 in reality, really, because Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, is often not there. He's very ill. He's in his 90s. And, you know, there are conservative Democrats, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana and Ben Nelson of Nebraska. Winning over a Republican or two is also about keeping those conservative Democrats in line. Of course, you then have to worry about the liberal Democrats like and liberal independents like Bernie Sanders. But the fact of the matter is they've looked at what it would take to pass this legislation using this parliamentary means called reconciliation with just a simple majority, and the political price will be very high. They are desperately trying to avoid that. To do that, they need 60 votes. It's not a question of, you know, it's not a question of just being able to say it's bipartisan. This is a simple matter of counting the votes.
Can we step back and take the long view just a little bit? Because 16 years ago, of course, President Clinton tried to do this, failed spectacularly. Jonathan, you had a really, I thought, quite fascinating piece with some of your colleagues about where the Obama administration lost control of this, obviously trying to, you know, come back from this next week, and why and how. And I thought that it had some very interesting points.
You know, going all the way back to 2005, a group of labor unions led by the SEIU, a group of patient advocacy organizations like the American Cancer Society's Action Network, and liberal healthcare groups like Families USA got together in what would become the Herndon Alliance. And this is in 2005. They started convening pollsters and focus groups and started trying to find the language that they could use to get healthcare a real big overhaul of healthcare through. Not only were they working on language, but you know, in 2007, Senator Kennedy started getting the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical industry, the hospitals, the doctors around the table. They spent an enormous amount of effort to line up all of the powers in Washington behind this. The feeling they kind of overlearned the lessons of 1993 and 1994. They thought, well, if we can just keep the insurance industry at bay, if we can keep the Harry and Louise ads off, then we can win this. But you know what they forgot to do was woo the American public, and it was interesting because in some ways they did exactly what they used to mock Hillary Clinton about. They lined up the powers that be in Washington and forgot the grassroots.
Well, I agree they did a good job co-opting the special interests that killed health care reform 16 years ago, and the constituents constituency they lost are the 80% of Americans who already have health insurance and are worried that in any kind of a big deal where insurance is expanded, that they will somehow lose. And I also think they underestimated the political fight. I mean, there is a constituency in this country that really doesn't recognize that President Obama won the election. And I think the way they've gone after him has taken the White House by surprise. And I think the Republican Party, with one or two exceptions, has made the decision that they are going to oppose whatever health care reform the White House comes up with and the Democrats come up with as a political matter. So I think they've won in a way the substance, and they've lost the political war so far. But I think there's still a couple more rounds in this fight.
Yeah, Eleanor's right. You know, the Obama forces prepared themselves for how they were going to respond to the charges of socialized medicine, government takeover of healthcare. They never expected to be responding to charges of forced euthanasia and death panels and forced abortions. They just, you know, you can't anticipate where the attacks are going to come from.
Yeah, you had one example of people sort of verbally attacking one congressman at a dumpster in Vermont, which I thought was fascinating. Well, we're going to come back in the next segment of the show, and we're also going to talk about Afghanistan, a very serious story developing there today. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking about the week in the news, and you can join the conversation. I'm joined by Newsweek contributing editor Eleanor Clift and also Jonathan Weissman, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Janine Zakaria, diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. We've been talking about health care, so let's take some listener calls. Bill is in Northborough, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Bill.
Thank you. I think the Democrats have lost their guts. They have no backbone. They can't stand up even against the obvious. There was an article in the commentary in the New York Times yesterday, and in the article, the writer pointed out that FDR totally ignored the Republicans after they won their election and was able to get things done. I just can't believe the Democratic Party is being as spineless as it is, and whoever came up with the idea that somehow or other bipartisanship, no matter what, is some sort of virtue. I can't think of one Republican, not one, that I would give a dime for. These people have reached the point of being so reactionary, and the Democrats can't stand up to these people.
All right. Well, thank you for that comment, Bill. Thanks very much. Let's go to Scotty, who's calling from Tell City, Indiana. Hi, Scotty.
Hello.
Welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you. Well, actually, I feel just the opposite of this young gentleman that just left the phone. This is really not a political issue. The issue is the working American people, the retired American people, and it's also about our children and grandchildren. We work, we try, and the harder we work, the more we try, the less we gain because of, let's start at the top. You want to reform health care, start at the top. Knock off all these high-interest people that run out here, and you have a little bump on your arm, and you sue them, and you get $25,000 for a scratch on your hand. Let's get the lawyers out of it.
Oh, you're talking about medical malpractice.
Yes, I am. Malpractice. That's exactly right. Those are just absolutely ridiculous in this country. I've worked as a 40% cripple man since 1976. I felt I was fair. You take care of me until my passing. When I'm dead, you can quit buying my pain pills. When I'm dead, you can quit buying my prescriptions and my built-up shoes. I didn't get a lawyer. We didn't get involved in all that. What's the point? It's ridiculous. You have good doctors that can't treat you for fear of being sued. Well, I'm sorry you can't afford a doctor, and I'm sorry you're laid off, but, you know, I would be glad to help you, and we'd have more money to help you if so much wasn't being wasted in the courts. Why am I not hearing either party, and I'm not a politician, why am I not hearing somebody say, well, you know, let's cap everything. Mm-hmm. Let's cap the settlements. Let's cap the cost of malpractice. Let's cap what we're going to give you. We're going to take care of you till you pass. We're not giving you a $100,000 check. We're going to take care of you.
So, Scotty, may I ask how old you are?
Yes, ma'am. You certainly can. I'm 60 years old.
All right.
I'm loving every minute of it. I'm a proud American.
Well, thank you so much for contributing to our debate, and in a civil way, because that isn't everything we've been seeing this summer. Sheila is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Sheila.
Hi. I'd like to say, in as far as the civil debate goes, I've been to several of the town hall meetings in Massachusetts over the summer. I went to one in Peabody. I went to Barney Frank's town meeting in Dartmouth, where there was a lot of shouting and yelling. I went to Senator Kerry's town meeting in Somerville a couple of nights ago, which was very different, much more restrained. And what I saw was partly a very vocal group of people who seemed to me to be similar to the people that I saw at Sarah Palin rallies before the election, who were very, very much against what they call big government. They were also, many of them, very, very much against President Obama, per se, as a person. And I saw the coverage, the press, going after the most vocal, the loudest, not necessarily the most reasoned people. At Senator Kerry's town hall, there were probably 20 or 25 questions which had to do with the possibility of single payer Medicare for all, with supporting the public option. And then there was one woman who was a Lyndon LaRouche supporter who stood up and started berating big government and said that it was going to turn into fascism and the government was trying to take us all over. And those were the people that the reporters went after and questioned at the end of the debate. And I think that the whole idea that President Obama is now playing defense is in part a bogus creation of the press, because they like to go after the big, noisy stories. And I think that the majority of the American people still want health care for everyone.
All right.
60% of doctors want health care for everyone.
Okay, Sheila, thank you very much, because I think that is a good point. And since we have three journalists with us, let's ask them about your point. Have we in the press focused too much, any of you, on the very noisy, very splashy blowback with lots of debates and clever words? Barney Frank telling one woman, you know, arguing with you is like arguing with the kitchen table, and I'm not going to do it. I mean, there has been a lot of American Chautauqua out there, I suppose you could say.
Well, the media thrives on conflict, and I think the impression has been created by a very angry, I believe, a minority, that there is a rebellion brewing in the country. And I think it has colored other people's attitudes. I mean, people who were either neutral or in favor of health care reform are now worried that they are somehow going to lose. And the fact that there hasn't been a realistic plan has allowed the opponents to conjure up all of these demons that might or might not be in the plan. And the White House, as we've said on this show and has been said repeatedly, has lost control of the debate. And the people who voted for Barack Obama can't understand that, because the Democrats control the White House. They have substantial majorities in both the House and the Senate. And because of the arcane way that the Senate works, you have a handful of senators from one committee now seeming to hold the balance of power. And you have the dominant sentiment within the Democratic Party seeming to be on the losing side. But as I said earlier, there's still a couple more rounds to this fight.
And I would agree that that there has been undue attention on the screaming and yelling. It would be pretty boring to watch a town hall meeting otherwise. And look, I think the biggest winner of August was Lyndon LaRouche, because a lot of these people who are just being aired as kind of spokespeople for the angry Americans really are these, like that Barney Frank altercation. These are followers of Lyndon LaRouche, who usually would not get the time of day from the press. So that's an odd thing. But look, we're not just, I think the press is not just looking at what's going on in these town hall meetings, we're also looking at what's going on in the polling. And polling is extremely consistent right now. Yes, if you ask if Americans want changes in healthcare, there still remains a very healthy majority of people who want some kind of overhaul of healthcare. But the president's approval ratings have slipped. His handling of healthcare as an issue has slipped precipitously, and there is concern. And for most Americans, they're not listening to the details of this screaming and yelling. All they're doing, they have no idea the details of what is being debated in Washington, what these people are yelling at. They just know, wow, you know, here's the president. He's a Democrat. He's got big Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, and there's a lot of screaming, and they're having a hard time passing this bill. Something must be wrong with it. It's zeitgeist, and zeitgeist is having an impact.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, can I just jump in here? I think one of the problems that he's had is trying to force this out, and this is the parallel from 94, just force it so quickly amidst the bailouts. One of the things that you hear from a lot of these people is, how are we going to pay for it? And it's not just the people yelling at the town halls, right? You've got other estimates here in Washington saying that it's not going to be, what is it called, debt neutral or deficit neutral. And that's one of the things that he's really going to have to talk about, besides answering the questions about whether the plan would fund abortions or provide health care for illegal immigrants or some of the other things that you're hearing at the town halls.
Yeah, Janine's right. You know, people feel like they're not even sure what's coming at them, but they know a lot is coming at them. You know, the forces for health care reform couldn't have known that when they finally got to it, it would come after a $700 billion bailout of Wall Street,
right,
after the rescue of AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, after the takeover of General Motors and the bailout of Chrysler. It just, to a lot of Americans, a lot is coming at them, and they're just feeling overwhelmed.
Well, let's turn the corner here a little bit and talk about another story that is with us every single day but seems to be barreling at us today, and that, of course, is Afghanistan. There's been another airstrike there today that killed scores of people. But yesterday, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Michael Mullen spoke with reporters at the Pentagon. And the Secretary of Defense acknowledged that the military's work in Afghanistan is far from over.
We are only now beginning to be in a position to have the assets in place that, and the strategy or the military approach in place to begin to implement the strategy. And this is going to take some time. By the same time, no one is more aware than General McChrystal and certainly the two of us that there is a limited time for us to show that this approach is working.
Janine, I know that you look at Afghanistan closely, and certainly August was a turning point month, not only because of the election, which is still being contested in certain provinces of Hamid Karzai, but also our spending up to $100 million a day. The death toll of troops last month, somewhere between 49 and 51, could go up as names get released. And some dissent amongst advisors to the president about whether to bring in more troops or not.
You know, it's, if you just listen to that quote again from the Secretary of Defense, think about how that's going to play in the public right now. We are only able now to start to have a strategy and have enough troops after 8 years. What an indictment of his former boss. And how are people going to react to that? They're going to say, what do you mean you're only about to have strategy? You had a lot of things happening in August which are undermining President Obama's push to really restore stability there. Of course, August 2009 already, the deadliest month, deadliest year since we invaded Afghanistan, and we're only in August. You had poll numbers showing that only 48% of Americans support Obama's handling of the Afghan situation, and you haven't heard that much from him. He did give one speech earlier in the month to the veterans of foreign wars, and it was not received very well. And there's three main things happening. One, this debate about the troop levels. They're going to have to sort this out in the next few weeks. It's already going to be going up to 68,000 U.S. troops. That's including the 21,000 plus up that President Obama talked about in January. And then you had the election in August. August 20th, which really the administration was banking on, even if it was just sort of fair, they could say, look, they're making progress towards stability, and then sort of lay the groundwork for some kind of withdrawal in a couple of years. But given the fact that it's so plagued by fraud, that's going to be very hard for them. And then you had this week this very disgusting, scandalous kind of release of what's going on with a contractor, a U.S. contractor, the embassy in Kabul, where they're operating in a, quote, Lord of the Flies environment, which I think Americans will look at this and say, what are we doing over there?
Mm-hmm. I think Americans don't know what we're doing over there. You know, it's one thing right after 9/11 to send the troops in to say we're going after after bin Laden. Well, now people think that the leadership of al-Qaeda is actually in Pakistan. And the president has not really made the case for why, what exactly the U.S. interests are in stabilizing Afghanistan.
Yeah. Eleanor.
Oh, I was just going to say this is not a war that President Obama launched, but he now has the responsibility to prosecute it. I think he'd like to hold the line on troops, and he's looking for a strategy that can destabilize the Taliban and al-Qaeda within Afghanistan, and that would be a war that would be fought by the Afghans, which was how we started this out 8 years ago. And the fact that President Bush didn't finish it and got distracted by Iraq has left the country and our presence there basically languishing for the last several years. I think it's really tempting to say, let's get out, but I don't know that that's realistic. And we can't fight the war in Pakistan because we're not invited to put boots on the ground in Pakistan. And so I think this is a question of making do, and I think they're struggling through to see if they can find a strategy that not only can achieve victory, but can even define what victory is. It's a very, very stiff challenge.
We just had some breaking news, Cross, and that is that the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan says it has fired 8 guards involved in that lewd conduct that Janine was describing. Let's take a listener call right now. Bob is calling from Warren, Michigan. Welcome to On Point, Bob.
Hi.
Hi. Hello, Bob. You're on the air.
I'm still here. Mm-hmm. I'm still here. No, I think what we need to do in Afghanistan, if we want to win there, is we're going to have to spend more money on civilian projects, and even at the expense of militarism, because basically every time we blow up something, we're pissing the Afghanis off and we're not improving their lives.
All right. Thank you for that question, Bob. That comment, yeah, I should say.
No, he's got a great point. Bob's got a great point. I mean, this is one of the things that Vice President Joe Biden, when he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was talking about. We've got to invest more both in Pakistan and Afghanistan in civilian infrastructure. And it's one of the things that Richard Holbrooke, the State Department's envoy on the region, is looking at. I mean, even in Pakistan, you've got a situation where they can't keep the lights on there, and this really upsets people. And that's something the U.S. can easily do in help in terms of infrastructure and projects like that. But in terms of the overall strategy that President Obama's looking for, it's really untested, this idea of, can you separate the Taliban that are willing to cooperate us from the Taliban that are not? And this requires money and essentially trying to buy warlords off and getting in on the ground in very dangerous areas. And the U.S., this is just such a difficult task for the U.S.
Well, I think I'd debate whether or not improving infrastructure in Afghanistan, which is often under control of those same warlords, is easy. But we'll come back to that point in the next part of our show. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. In some other news this week, Good Morning America host Diane Sawyer will replace ABC's world news anchor Charlie Gibson. He's stepping down in January.
I'm Charlie Gibson, and I hope you had a good day. For all of us at ABC News, have a good night.
Sesame Street's Elmo has been recruited to help kids prevent the spread of the H1N1 flu.
Come on, practice washing your hands with Elmo. Wash, 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 wash.
Keep washing, and you'll stay happy and healthy on Sesame Street.
And superstar Whitney Houston makes a comeback with her new single, I Look to You.
After all, my strength is gone.
And you can join the conversation. What about the fires in Southern California, the economy, the latest jobless numbers? You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined by Newsweek contributing editor Eleanor Clift, also Jonathan Weissman, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Janine Zakaria, diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. Folks, before we carry on, let's take another call. Kevin is calling from Mount Vernon, Iowa.
Thanks for taking my call. Sort of a general comment, covers a lot of the different topics, or at least part of the cause for some of the unrest in the voting electorate is that I think you got a third of the people would voted for Obama, a third would vote and would vote for anything he does, and another third for the Republican, no matter what they say. But there's a third of us in the middle, the independents. And while we did not like George Bush at all, primarily because of starting a couple wars that some of us don't think were all that wise, number two, running at the time were astronomical deficits and all sort of things that LBJ would have passed. And here we've got Mr. Obama, who's trying to do all of the things George Bush did, and then on spending, it even more multiples than that. And we may not lead the world in math, but a lot of us can add. And some of us who are grandparents are concerned about passing on astronomical debts to our children. And the other thing is how Mr. Obama has not made the case on how all this is going to get paid for. There aren't enough, quote, rich people around to tax enough to cover his spending list. I mean, the Cato Institute and others have demonstrated that he's going to have to reach back into the middle class to cover a lot of this expense.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. Let's listen to Vice President Joe Biden talking about the final push for the health care bill. He was talking about the economic stimulus package. Here he is this week at the Brookings Institution, actually yesterday.
Are we there yet? No. But we're moving. 200 days ago, President Obama signed into law the third piece of our economic plan, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And today, there's a growing consensus. The Recovery Act is, in fact, working.
Janine, Eleanor, Jonathan, you've all been talking about all the things the administration is trying to do at the same time, from health care to Afghanistan. Do you think the economic stimulus recovery, are people beginning to believe that that's working?
Well, the polls show that I think a plurality of people don't think it's working, and yet the economic experts are crediting it with stopping the slide into a Great Depression, and the stimulus package is sort of time released over the next year and a half. So I think the reasoned conclusion on that is that it is working. But people are worried about the mounting deficits. And there is a method, though, to the president's madness in terms of this spending. And that is he has two agendas. He has the one that he inherited, which was rescuing the economy. And he basically adopted Keynesian thinking that you had to spend government money in order to get the country recovering. And second, he has the agenda that he campaigned on, which is health care reform, energy independence, and education reform. And he is interlocking that with much of that with the economic crisis, pointing out that if we do not reform health care spending, that we will be that it's unsustainable. And so this is something that he believes he not only wants to do for as a moral imperative, but that he wants to do in order to bring it into a more realistic economic picture.
I mean, we got the sobering news this morning that unemployment climbed last month to 9.7% from 9.4%. There is an expectation that we'll reach 10%. The government says that we will shed another 220,000 or so jobs last month. And the best you can say on the jobs front is that the numbers are slowing. We haven't started recovering. And that was always going to happen. Employment is always a lagging indicator. So as other things start bottoming out and actually bouncing up, unemployment will continue to rise. And politically, that's what is the most important factor. That is what people are looking at. They're looking at their own daily lives and the threat to their own jobs. And that's going to be a huge problem for the president.
And if you look at those unemployment figures, if you actually factor in people who are working part-time and rather be working full-time or people who have given up on trying to find a job, I think it goes even higher to like 16.8%
right.
or mm-hmm. something like that. So, yeah, that's definitely not something that is going to be – it's going to be very sobering for the White House. And one of the things, if I take this into my arena a little bit of foreign policy, is what is the Chinese appetite to buy up all this debt? When is that going to end? And how does that affect the administration's dealings with that economy and that country on so many issues? And I'm sensing within the administration that there is some concern about that maybe it's not a never-ending appetite.
There is a huge concern. You know, I remember a few weeks back I was working on a story about just this case. How long can the international community float the U.S. debt? And as soon as word got out that the Wall Street Journal was doing this story, within a half hour I got a call from Peter Orszag, the budget director, Larry Summers, the director of the National Economic Council, and then Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary. They are very concerned.
So were you able to tell them how long the foreign governments will hold on? Yes.
I'm sorry?
I said, were you able to tell them how long, Janine or Jonathan, Eleanor, how long foreign governments will have appetite to buy American debt? I mean, that is
a huge question. It's one of those things that we've always wondered. We've always had this doomsday scenario, but there is something of a mutually assured destruction here. The Chinese own so many dollars and so many dollar-denominated assets that if they stop buying, everything in their portfolio will crash, and then they will be in big trouble. So I think the United States is not just counting on the kindness of strangers. It's counting on the Chinese not to destroy their own nest egg.
The Chinese economic future is totally intertwined with the U.S. economic future. They need us as much as we need them.
Well, here's another crystal ball comment. Of course, we're emanating out of Boston, and the sad passing of Senator Kennedy has left vacant his seat. And, of course, there will be a contest for that seat. Yesterday, Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley announced her plans to run for the empty Senate seat. Let's hear from her.
I have decided to run for the Senate because I believe the government has to work well and it has to work for everyone. I believe that is the promise upon which our democracy has been based. And frankly, I believe it's time to renew that promise.
Now, of course, by losing Senator Kennedy, the Obama administration loses not only a friend, but someone who had been a guiding light on health care and other pieces of legislation. How do you think this is going to affect what's happening in health care and other matters?
Well,
the most immediate threat is that Kennedy is the 60th vote, and I gather that the lawmakers in Boston are going to be meeting to see if they can change the law so that the governor can name an interim placeholder until the election is held, I believe, in January.
And they are counting on it. I was speaking to a senior senator a couple of days ago who really believes that they will have that 60th seat before the final vote on the health care plan. I mean, Senator Kennedy's death did create a truce in some of the rhetoric, and it lasted for about maybe 48 hours, and it's already over.
Yeah. Well, part of his legacy is that Senator Kennedy believed that you don't always get what you want. You don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You get something you can build a foundation on. And I'm sure if President Obama is forced to scale back his plan for health care reform, that he's going to invoke Senator Kennedy and say this is something we can build on for the future.
You know, one of the things that struck me looking at the news this week, and Jonathan, I'll invite you to comment, but I definitely want to hear from Janine and Eleanor, this seismic shift in women in the workforce, certainly partly because of the recession, but a historic shift in terms of the number of women in the workforce since World War II, really, and then also Diane Sawyer becoming the second evening news anchor. It strikes me, at least, that we really are turning a corner here as a society. Does it strike you that way?
Well, it's certainly showing, as you pointed out, that there's definitely strains on the economy. And also, I mean, just some of it is just women's advancement, right? But it definitely indicates that there's a lot of juggling going on within families of how to balance the work and the home and in the current economic environment. That's obviously quite difficult. And it shows also on the positive side, women's advancements. I'm struck by, though, as a female journalist, all of the attention on the Diane Sawyer appointment, given the fact that women are, you know, at least on my beat and the diplomatic beat, I think we outnumber the men here in Washington. And so I guess it's just something, given that the evening news' vaunted position, but even that is ebbing, I guess, with the change in the way people get their news.
Mm-hmm. Well, the diplomatic beat was once all male.
I know.
And now we've had three female secretaries of state in a row. So in many ways, it's kind of unremarkable. And the fact that women outnumber men 60% to 40% on college campuses has actually created some worry about the future of men in this society. But look, the evening newscasts have chewed up women in the past. Barbara Walters didn't make it. Sally Quinn, I think maybe she was even morning TV.
Connie Chung
would be another one. And so the fact that this is almost unremarked, I think the fact that there are two out of three women in these very coveted evening slots really reflects the changes throughout society.
Well, and a part of the reason that women have moved into more jobs in the workplace is they're predominant in sectors that have been somewhat less hard hit than construction and manufacturing.
You can't really have households now with just one income. It's
too expensive.
And
in fact, when we look at this almost saturation point of women moving into the job market, you realize the real uphill climb for long-term growth in this country. I mean, one of the buoys of the 60s and 70s, 80s, 90s, the long-running increases in growth in this country were marked by the rising tide of a workforce coming in. Well, you know, that we can't count on just getting more money because more people are going into the workforce. Now everybody's in the workforce.
Well, I still think that watching Diane Sawyer and seeing whether or not she will succeed, Eleanor mentioned her sort of the and you all have other people who've been chewed up in that very position is going to be fascinating. And then we also had the account from Laura Ling and Una Lee in a Los Angeles Times op-ed piece about their time in North Korea. I don't know if you had a chance to their time. I'm making it sound like a holiday, hardly. Of course, they are the two women who were held captive for 4.5 months in North Korea. But a fascinating account of what happened to them.
Yeah, I think that it was in the sense, and I think it was definitely overdue, the sense that, you know, people said, what were these two women doing from current TV wandering into North Korea? And so they tried to explain how they were lured across the border for a second by one of their escorts and then sort of back in China when the North Koreans came in and actually dragged them physically across back the border. It was a very dramatic account of what had happened. But it certainly raises the questions of how can journalists and also new media organizations that don't have the backing of the New York Times and whatever, how does any foreign journalist report in these repressive areas, and how do you get the stories out of the crimes that are going on inside North Korea against the people? And that's something that hasn't been resolved. It just struck me also when I was reading that I was recently on a trip with Secretary Clinton to Africa, and she basically in an interview made a public service announcement to journalists, stay away from these border areas, because in the end of the day, the State Department then has to work behind the scenes to rescue them. But it definitely begs the question of how can we report on repression abroad? It's a serious one.
Absolutely. And I like their point about it. We feel it our responsibility to shine a light, and I think that's held true. Well, I want to shine one more because I know that parents and many of us have to be thinking about this because we're all in this together, and that is about swine flu and its return. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano told NBC's Today Show on Wednesday that more H1N1 cases are on the horizon.
Well, the best thing we all can do are the very simple things, the washing of the hands, the coughing into the sleeve. We know that we're going to have a big influx of flu cases, and it's coming back to the northern hemisphere after circulating around the southern hemisphere. And we're going to, in all likelihood, have them before the vaccine is ready.
Well, do people feel confident that the vaccine is ready? And are any of you parents with youngsters being coached to wash your hands to the tune of happy birthday, because that's how long it should, washing your hands should last in order to
well,
be clean.
Well, I have a daughter who is immune suppressed, and she's 6 years old, and her rheumatologist is lining up an H1N1 shot for her as soon as it's available, with the expectation that it is not going to be available to the greater public. This is going, there's going to be a rush and a panic, and even if Elmo just tells us to wash our hands, the other Elmo mushes might be run for the hills.
Are you worried?
Well, I was on a small college campus in Illinois last week, and there are hand sanitizing stations set up in all of the buildings. And this particular college had recorded its first case of the H1N1 flu, and they were not releasing the name, the gender, nothing. And so I had dinner with students, and the young man sitting next to me told me he was the roommate of the guy who had gotten the flu. And he said, oh, he had 102 fever for an afternoon. It wasn't so bad. He wasn't writhing and saying he was going to will me his futon. And this particular young man was actually felt very invulnerable, because he had been tested and he had not contracted the flu, and there was a 2 to 3 gestation period. He was fine. His roommate was back in class. But, you know, I still think that the colleges and schools everywhere are bracing for what could be a lot of cases of the flu.
Well, I think we're all going to need to be vigilant. Anyway, thank you all very, very much for being with us today. Janine Zakaria, diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. Janine, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Eleanor Clift, contributing editor for Newsweek. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Jackie.
And Jonathan, we wish you very good things at home. White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks very much. This is On Point.